This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Are very excited about. They call it the teaching hospital model, right? So you actually have working journalists together with the academics. So the research, teaching, and service is integrated, and we all learn from each other.
Downey says he was flabbergasted when he first heard the legislature was seeking to end the university's partnership with the Center for Investigative Journalism. Downey says the university fully stands by the center's watchdog reporting of Wisconsin state government and other investigative work done for the public interest.
And they've even watchdogged our campus and our UW system, sometimes to the chagrin, perhaps, of UW administrators. But they've demonstrated their independence, even from us.
The two-sentence provision that prohibits the Center for Investigative Journalism from occupying any campus offices also bars any university employees from working with the center, including staff at Wisconsin Public Radio and Television. The Republican co-chairs on the Budget Committee introduced the provision as part of the committee's final motion. Representative Corey Mason, a Democrat, is a minority member of the committee and voted against the motion.
This is usually where you want to look most for some bad ideas that get slipped in the middle of the night. Nobody had any idea this was coming. And interestingly, none of the Republicans would take credit for it either.
The motion passed with little discussion along party lines, 12-4. Republican Senator Glenn Grothman is also a member of the Budget Committee. He says that many members of his caucus believe that the Center for Investigative Journalism has a left-wing bias, although he won't identify any legislators by name.
It's one of those things that just surrounds us in the air.
Grothman says he first learned about the provision to boot the center off campus 4 or 5 hours before he voted on it. Grothman supports the measure, but he's also not thrilled that it was tacked on to the huge state budget bill right before it moves on to the full legislature.
I wanted to see that motion voted on later. I think it looks bad to vote on a motion that whenever we voted on it, 5:30 in the morning or something. What am I going to do, walk out of the room? I mean, that's what we were throwing. That's what the boss says. That's what I got to do. I got to vote on it at 5:30 in the morning.
The Wisconsin Assembly and Senate take up the two-year budget this week and are scheduled to have a final budget for Republican Governor Scott Walker to sign by Friday. A few of the more moderate Republicans in the state Senate have come out in support of the center, but critics of the measure aren't sure it'll be enough. Again, Bill Leaders with the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism.
We hope that the legislature will reconsider this decision and remove it from the budget. If that doesn't happen, we hope that Governor Scott Walker will veto it.
And what if the Republicans' eviction notice is included in the final state budget?
Well, they can't stop us from doing investigative journalism, and we will continue to do that, and we'll continue to do good work, I'm sure. What they can do is make it much more difficult for the center to give something back to the state of Wisconsin.
The Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism is also not ruling out legal action. Dylan Brogan, FSRN, Madison.
And that's the program for today. The newscast was produced by Catherine Kopp. Thanks for listening. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina.
Wisdom of the Elders is committed to Native American cultural sustainability, multimedia education, and race conciliation. It especially seeks to correct misconceptions and prejudice, to bring health and wellness to Native people, and demonstrate how Indian culture has and is continuing to enrich our worlds. An Evening with Wisdom of the Elders, its second annual gala, is planned for Friday, June 21st, at 6:30 p.m. in the Rose Ballroom of the Ainsworth Event Center in Southwest Portland. The featured guest and keynote speaker will be Deanna D. Dart, Ph.D., curator of Native American art at the Portland Art Museum. Cedar Rose will perform a collaborative musical effort that focuses on traditional and contemporary Native American sounds formed by Karen Kitchen and Nico Wind. More information about this KBOO-sponsored event may be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
The time is 6:04. You are listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next is Out Loud, KBOO's queer culture radio show.
This program is made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Radio Cab, serving the metro area since 1946 with service 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. Radio Cab offers airport service, wheelchair-accessible vans, and can be reached at 503-227-1212. In Vancouver at 360-694-1234 or RadioCab.net.
This KABU program is made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Yellow Pages, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit pdxgyp.com.
Welcome to Out Loud, Portland's queer culture radio program. This is Sasha. I hope everybody out there is having a wonderful summer evening, almost officially summer anyway. Hope everybody's doing well. We have a really great program, as always, tonight. The full hour is going to be a conversation with Tristan Cotton, who has written a first-of-its-kind series of testimonies of transsexual men's experience of sexual reassignment surgery. Before we jump into that, though, I just want to say happy Pride Month to everyone and remind folks that Pride is not over by any means. Portland Black Pride is kicking off on June 19th with a kickoff party, and then there's going to be a great casino mixer on Thursday, June 20th, and on June 21st, it's going to be rice, beans, and collard greens, and also a bunch more events culminating with a great extravaganza Vogue ball that's going to happen on Saturday, June 22nd. So catch all of those great events, and you can find out more information and locations and times, etc., either on Facebook, Portland PFLAG Black Chapter, or they have a website at pflagpdx.org/WordPress. So you can get more information there about what's going on there. And also Portland Latino Gay Pride is going to be happening in July, and you can go to their website and get more information at plgp.org. Okay, so we're going to jump right into this. It's an interview with Tristan Cotton, who I said is the author of a great new anthology called Hung Jury, Testimonies of Genital Surgery by Transsexual Men. And I just opened this conversation with asking Tristan just a little bit about himself and the new book.
Demographically.
Sounds great. Absolutely.
Right?
Exactly. Yeah, no, I think it's a really important point, too, because people treat you very differently. They perceive you as being transgender than Tyra Hunter. I think our cable listeners are very interested, so it'd be great if you could just touch on it.
No good. A menace to society.
Gotcha. Gosh. So helpful to dig into why those intersections matter and what happens and why the safety is great. And also, if you could just, I think there's probably folks that are interested, if you could let folks know how they can. And I would imagine that the book's helpful for folks who are considering, their different options too, their different surgeries. Awesome. Thank you so much, Tristan. I mean, this is such an important conversation, deconstructing these myths.
Studies in African-American studies at Cal State Stanislaus. And I've been an activist, LGBT activist for quite some time, for probably about 12 or 15 years or so, long before my transition. Just recently, over the last year, began a press called Transgress Press. We're at www.transgresspress.org, and the purpose of our press is to basically, in every way possible, to serve the trans and queer communities. And one of the things I've come to realize as an academic is that, particularly someone working in gender studies, is that a lot of the people who work on trans people and trans lives, trans history, a lot of us, there's a lot of, how do I put this in a nice way, there's a lot of benefits and a lot of perks for people who are sort of doing that, but people who are working in the field and academia, but also for publishers, and particularly large-scale publishers like Routledge and large-scale distribution centers like Amazon.com and things like that. And so what I came to realize after all these years is that when I look at our community and the places that we're in terms of, you know, I'm thinking of poor people, poor trans people, I'm thinking of trans immigrants, trans people of color, trans women, you know, people who are really particularly vulnerable in our community, we're in a tight spot. A lot of us, I mean, I'm sure you know that the statistics for us for suicide is through the roof, and more than any other population that you can break down demographically. So, the reason that I began to realize is that a lot of us we're in a real bad predicament, and but we're not being served by a lot of the groups that make money off of us in terms of like Routledge or that's one I keep coming up with, but that's the one sort of, that's who I tend to publish with, or SUNY, or some of the, you know, the large scale university publishers, as well as other kind of mainstream publishers who all seem to sort of get on the bandwagon now, the trans. They all want to sort of get on the bandwagon, and so we set up Transgress Press as a way to benefit the community, bring that money back into the community, because we realized that both intellectuals as well as people working in the publishing world were making money, basically, and getting promotions and things like that off of the work that we do, but that those perks and that money was not making it back to our community to help serve our community. So that's what we developed this press, Transgress Press, as a way to funnel the profits back into our community, to particularly those of us who are most vulnerable to oppression, you know, in a variety of different ways. So Hung Jury is one book among many books that we published. It is our first book. It is our inaugural book, but we've got some other books that are coming up as well. And this book for me has both a professional and a personal motivation, I guess, dimension to it. So I'll start with the personal and then kind of work my way to the professional. Am I doing okay, Sasha?
Sounds great. Thank you.
Okay. So personally, what I realized is in our community, in the trans male community, there wasn't a lot of conversation about genital surgery, or what I prefer to call genital confirmation surgery, mm-hmm. for female to male transsexuals. And of the conversations or of the discourse that was being promoted both on the web and sort of community lore, as well as even in academia, you can, you know, quote some people from academia, the general view was very pessimistic, Sasha. Mm-hmm. And what this was doing was it was discouraging a lot of men from thinking about genital surgery or thinking that they had other options besides just top surgery. And it's also, genital surgery is a kind of a lightning rod for a critical debate, both in academia as well as in our trans community. And so just to give you a little bit of idea of what that discourse is, it's generally people would sort of focus on aesthetics and on functionality, mm-hmm. and by aesthetics, or what I mean is more like appearance, right? Mm-hmm. So and people were sort of very negative about that, saying that, you know, the appearance of post-operative results were poor, and that the functionality didn't exist or were poor as mm-hmm. well, and that there are lots of complications. So it's a very pessimistic or rather negative discourse about genital surgery for trans guys. And what I came to realize is that a lot of this information that was being passed on wasn't really being passed on by people who had the surgery. In other words, these people didn't have any experience. They hadn't gone through the process. They, you know, and what they were saying was sort of by word of mouth. So it was like sort of hearsay and conjecture. So someone heard it from somebody who's heard from somebody. Mm-hmm. But that was enough to create this very strong hold kind of view of genital surgery as a total failure, basically. Mm-hmm. And so it was giving guys this notion that they didn't have options, and very much misinforming people. But beyond misinforming people, it was also, in a way, problematic of a way of talking about our bodies, because some of the things that people were saying were calling some of the post-operative results of trans male penises, things like Franken mm-hmm. or genital mutilation, mm-hmm. Or things like you get it's in the book, actually, it comes up a few times. I talk about this in the introduction. Sometimes the trans community lore, people would just spout out anything, sort of, you know, the appearances look like a piece of meat hanging between somebody's legs and don't really look like anything real, they don't work, or that was just sort of these ideas that were being constantly perpetuated in the community, both on the chat lines as well as in the FDM phalloplasty websites, and you'd find it sometimes in different places in academia as well. So that was sort of the general view. It didn't work. But what I had a problem on top of the problem with that is on top of misinforming people and creating all these myths that weren't quite true, that weren't exactly true or even close to true for what people's experiences was, is that this was a really problematic way to talk about transsexual men's bodies. Mm-hmm. And in many ways, what it did was sort of reinforce the mainstream normative view of us anyway as freaks and weirdos. And so this was also had this discourse sort of lack of self-reflexivity to it about the ways in which we're contributing to just really negative images and ideas about trans people and trans men in particular. And I think that also has an impact on trans men as well, beyond just misinforming them, but it also has an impact in terms of psychologically and emotionally, because we have lots of smaller communities that we break down into, but I still sort of think of trans people as one sort of, and maybe this is my idealism, but we are kind of one large family. We have problems and
agreed.
We have dissent and difficulties, but I still see as one family.
Absolutely.
And so what I realized is it's kind of hurtful for one family member to sort of say this to another, or the impact on trans men who had gone through this process. The impact was psychologically damaging, and beyond it being just culturally, reinforcing negative stereotypes and ideas about us. And so what I wanted to, say to sort of people with this book is, look, there's a person on the end of this penis thing that you're talking about or that you're disparaging, and that these are people with emotions and investments in our bodies, and we have an altogether whole set of different reasons for going through the surgery and than what people really think, than what people really understand. And so there were so many different layers of problems with this discourse, in addition to it just being dehumanizing, being reinforcing the cultural stereotypes and misinforming people. There were all of these layers that were problematic about it. And on top of that, people could never really get to talking about the transformative outcomes for trans men, because the general view was that, okay, well, it doesn't work. So that's not – so what we decided to do with Hung Jury was to take on that discourse and to provide a kind of corrective, interventionary voice to it, and to do that from men who've actually been through the surgery themselves. In other words – hear it from the horse's mouth, what it's really like to go through this experience and what the outcomes are and what all the causes are. So, we couldn't even begin to talk about the transformative outcomes of general surgery because the discourse was so negative. So one of the things that Hungary does is dispel those myths and takes on and intervenes in that discourse and tries to give you a perspective from our experience, our own embodiment, and how it changed our lives. So one of the things that you find out in the book is that it's not true about the aesthetics and the sensitivity. And let me just add something too about aesthetics. Another thing, Sasha, that I had a problem with, the discourse about the appearance of our genitalia after surgery, is that it really invoked cisgender men's genitalia and a very idealistic cisgender men, or a very idealistic image of cisgender men's penises as a standard, as a normative standard. And I had a lot of problems with that, particularly from people who identify themselves as feminists or cultural theorists in the academy, who just seem to sort of unself-reflectively draw up on cis male bodies as a standard for devaluing or judging and devaluing trans male bodies. I don't even think people were realizing they were doing that, but that's exactly what they were doing. And that's a bit contradictory to some of these people whose projects it is to deconstruct normative gender and sexual concepts. So this was another level of trying to engage and intervene in that discourse and sort of, bring people to a kind of or raise people's consciousness, bring them to a level of awareness and sensitivity about our bodies and what we were going through. So one of the things that you find in the book is that many men do have sensitivity in their penises. They have quite a bit of sensation, and they function just fine, both in terms of, so what I mean by functionality, I should explain that. What I mean by functionality is both basically sexual functioning and also urinal, being able to stand and urinate. And so many men have can achieve both of those. So it's a lot of men go overseas. They go to places like in Europe and Thailand and South America to get those things because the doctors in this country, many of them don't allow, some of them can't do that, particularly like the urethral hookup and to allow a person to stand and urinate. Or the problem is that it's very, very expensive in this country if you can find a doctor to do that. So you can go somewhere else and get that. And so what we were finding is that men, a lot of the men who had wonderful postoperative results, they would just sort of go on off in the sunset, and you'd never hear from them again. And that's part of the reason why you had this this pessimistic discourse sort of allowing to be, you know, the why it was perpetuated and why allowed it to perpetuate for so long, and how it reigned for so long without anyone sort of coming back and saying, okay, this is problematic, we need to rethink this. So what we did with Hung Jury is we went out and we found men who'd actually been through the experiences, and we got their testimonies. And we did a range of experiences of men who went all over the world, different countries. We have men who from different ethnic, national, and racial backgrounds, different class categories. And we also decided to include partners into this book. We have five testimonies by partners because, you know, as someone who works in gender studies and just as an activist in general in trans circles, it's I'm struck sometimes by the separation of partners from or at least a separation of understanding how their lives also change as we're transforming our bodies and our minds. So I'm often struck by how much of the partner's voice isn't taken into account or is sort of left out of the work that we do. So we decided in Hung Jury to include a section for partners because this was a very important event in the lives of people who were, you know, partnered, you think. And so there's a section for that. And so what you find is some of their experiences and the ways that the ways that surgery impacts their relationships, their emotional and sexual connections. So that's kind of it, the book, the structure of the book. And what we found, some of the things that I learned in the process and that we don't talk about are the transformative outcomes, quite literally, how sometimes people, how for some men, for example, it's very important for them to be able to have sexual intercourse in a way that they feel is male for them. And that changes for everybody's different, you know, whatever male intercourse is. I think that's a very individual thing. But for some men, in order for them to be able to open up and come to their part, bring all of themselves to the table and to be vulnerable and to experience that emotional and sexual connection, it's very important for them to have lower surgery and to have a penis where they can express themselves in the way that they felt most proper for, you know, in terms of their own imagination and their own embodiment. And what we found also is and I'm going to get to some more because it's not just about sex, actually. Surprisingly, there's a lot more transformative impact than just the sort of the sexual emotional connection. But this was a bit of a surprise because we just hadn't anticipated the impact and couldn't really know what that would be. So some of the testimonies will, even from the partners, will talk about them having a much more deeper romantic connection as a result of the surgery because their partners can open up and bring themselves fully to the relationship and also express themselves. And also the partners who are part of that process feel that energy more and they feel like they can that there's more connectivity between them and their partners. So because you don't have the dysphoria going on there where the person is somehow split off from themselves or part of them is sort of trying to manage, you know, this bottom half. So part of it was like enhanced sexual, emotional, romantic connection for couples. But another thing that was really interesting and that we learned from the book and from testimonies is that many men have had difficulty trying. Let me back up and put it this way. You transition socially and hormonally, mm-hmm. and you transition somewhat surgically when we have top surgery and we grow beards. Some of us shave, but you know, you masculinize mm-hmm. your body. That hormone, testosterone, masculinizes your body, and you also become seen as male in the world. Mm-hmm. And so your physical embodiment changes as male, and also your social embodiment changes as male. And that is sufficient for some men. Some men, that's perfectly fine for them, and they can get through life. In fact, they don't have the dysphoria with their genitals, and that's fine for them. But other men do have the dysphoria. Mm-hmm. But on top of the dysphoria, one of the things that we find is the social milieu. And there was sometimes men felt limited, Sasha, in being able to connect with other men in social situations. And this was a bit of a surprise, too. So he didn't think about things like, you know, the more you become embodied male socially and you move into circles with men and participate in men's culture and things like gay bars, for example, or things like going to hot tubs or going hiking, swimming, these things like this, things where your genitals actually come into play in mm-hmm. some way, or they become, they can come into play.
Yeah.
So one of the things that guys sort of talked about is feeling prevented or not prevented, but held back a little bit or hindered mm-hmm. from being able to partake in certain social activities with men, like going, you know, hanging out, hiking, for example. For example, like one guy talks about just really getting tired at some point of always having to be the guy who needs to find a tree.
Mm-hmm.
And how demeaning that sort of felt to him, and also how he had to sort of manage that with other men. Who, mm-hmm. That he, whether other men were aware, made an issue or thought about it or not, he himself was very self-conscious of this. And so this was a problem in terms of his being able to just fully, you know, relax and bond with other men, mm-hmm. Whether it's camping kinds of things or going into the hot tub or things like that. And, you know, some men, they pack with a little piece, a little packy, a soft pack. Mm-hmm. But even sometimes then what happens is that if you're in a swimming pool or if you're in a hot tub, that thing sort of moves around
yeah.
sometimes. And mm-hmm. so it starts floating around and you don't look, you know, you don't look natural, in
right.
other words, the way the guys want to look. And so that can be embarrassing.
Mm-hmm.
And even, you know, that can sometimes draw strange looks. It can even out you, or it can make you also feel very, very anxious at the moment. So there's a lot of things going on at that time when, you know, guys are engaging with other men in social spaces and they feel very self-conscious that their genitals are either going to prevent them from partaking and enjoying themselves fully and just letting go and enjoying themselves fully, or in this case, feeling embarrassed or self-conscious if something were to happen. And a very good example is Lou Sullivan, for example, who in his attempt to he's you know you remember you know so you know Lou Sullivan, he's sort of the father of trans male movement, and did a lot of work in terms of fighting back against the gender clinic system and the normative sex and gender, you know, standards that they employed when they were dealing with us in the 80s.
Oh, great.
Yeah, so Lou was an incredible activist and really sort of put men on the map, gave us some visibility. But he was very important in a large way to trans movement and our fight struggle against the institutionalization of our gender stuff. And so Lou was a gay man and also a trans man.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the things that was difficult for Lou to do sometimes is to be able to move in gay male spaces where... So actually, I'm gonna actually read a little bit of a quote here from the biographer of Sullivan. His name is Bryce Smith. He actually wrote a piece for Hung Jury.
Oh, great.
So Lou found it difficult to do that sometimes because, you know, the penis was an important. I don't want to just read. So I want to be careful. I don't want to stereotype gay men as mm-hmm. being just sexually focused and being penis oriented.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't want to pretend like the penis doesn't matter either in this context, right?
Exactly.
So one of the things that Lou's biographer Bryce writes in his biography, he says, quote, hormones and top surgery had enabled Lou Sullivan to feel like he was accepted unequivocally as a gay man socially. But Lou felt like he was in no man's land sexually. Hmm. And for Lou and others, sex was the primary means of validating one's gay identity. Hmm. Lou found it difficult to communicate with sexual partners about his own body. In less than a month, he had 3 sexual interactions that left him feeling rejected, insecure, and anatomically inadequate. So in this is a end quote, sorry. So in this context, you have both the social and the sexual kind of coming together, and you see how how Lou can feel very self-conscious, he can feel hindered, or he indeed felt hindered by his genitals, his preoperative genitals, in terms of not just hooking up with gay men, but really enjoying social bonding with other men. One of the things, the most obvious thing that comes up is the locker room for trans men, mm-hmm. and the fear of other guys seeing you, or figuring things out, or sometimes men feel like they can't go into the locker room. Some men actually just go to the gym and then they just go home and shower. Mm-hmm. But there's a certain kind of camaraderie and bonding that goes on sometimes in locker rooms, and mm-hmm. so both for the need to be able to go into that space and feel safe, mm-hmm. right? And to also be able to connect with other men. Some men feel that this is really important to have, that their genitalia matches their outer male presentation. And so also getting to the issues, for example, like safety.
Yeah.
You know, this is as trans people, we are always at risk, I think, mm-hmm. In many ways, even for those of us who look mm-hmm. Unequivocally one gender or another, we are still at risk, both of being identified, whether because of identification documents or because of someone finds out, you know, that our genitals don't match our what they think our gender is, or just sometimes people are just, you know, they're mean and they're just anti-trans. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things that comes up for folks is safety issues, mm-hmm. and being afraid of being outed, and what happens, you know, if someone finds out that your genitalia doesn't match your gender presentation. And so a good example would be something like being profiled, being mm-hmm. racially. Oh, so here's a good example where you can, yeah, because some of the guys talk about this. You can be, let's say you look unequivocally one gender or the other. Mm-hmm. Let's say you're not identified, your trans status is not necessarily written on your body visibly, on the legibility of your body, mm-hmm. like invisible way. Mm-hmm. But there are other ways that you have other identity markers or other aspects about your body that can make you, that can bring you into contact with people who can hurt you or make your genital. Sasha.
Yeah, no worries. Yeah, and I think it's really, I think it's a really important point too, because people treat you very differently when they perceive you as being transgender than if they don't.
Yes, they do. And okay, so let me back up, and before I get to the sort of the intersectional piece, let me back up and say, start a little bit over here and say that about the safety piece. For example, if we're in a medical situation, the question is, you know, we're in a vulnerable spot. Emergency medical situation, you need care, you need attention, and you don't want someone to, let's say you're in a car accident, you don't want, they cut your clothes off, and then all of a sudden you flip out, and this has happened, mm-hmm. Sasha, this mm-hmm. has happened in the medical field, in the emergency field, and actually. Mm-hmm.
Tyra Hunter.
So you know what I'm talking mm-hmm. about. It makes me upset just thinking about it. We can be vulnerable in an emergency medical situation, require care, need that care, but then the people who are not trained properly, mm-hmm. Then freak out. And then when they see that we look different from their expectations below. And so one of the men in the book actually talked about this. He actually feels some relief now that he's had metoidioplasty, which allows, you know, which gives him a semblance, you know, a penis. He has a penis, you know, it's a small penis, but it's a penis. Mm-hmm. And he feels safer now, at least in terms of if he's in a situation where he may need medical care, he hopes that, you know, they'll figure it out. But at least, you know, it's not a situation where you're going to have people standing around sort of thinking, okay, what, you know, snickering, making jokes, you know, figuring out, well, what do we do with this person or you know, or God knows whatever they say. So in some ways, it gives guys a sense of relief or takes a little bit of that pressure off of feeling like you're being caught with your pants down, so to speak. Another instance would be people who are sort of stopped and searched crossing national borders. And this is a really important thing, particularly for trans people and for trans people of color. And, you know, nowadays we have these scanner machines that they can see you full body and they can see through and they can see what we have. And so one of the things that sometimes guys have anxiety about is when they're traveling, wondering whether or not they are going to be clocked as trans if they get patted down or if they go through this machine. Do I have the right, are they going to feel what they should feel or not? And Sasha, they do come quite close to you. It's not, and sometimes I've had people come quite all the way up to my genitalia, you know, in terms of patting me down. So it's not really, I don't think it's really standardized. But these going through traveling across national borders, going through these really intense surveillance technologies that are designed to just penetrate all the way through, whether it's through whether it's a human pat down or a demographic emission machine, what have you. Our identities are always always constantly vulnerable or in question, could be thrown into interrogation. And I do know some stories where trans men have been pulled aside and taken in the back and strip searched or taken aside and patted down, and then it becomes revealed either they have a packy, and then that's just assumed to be some sort of device that they're trying to hide, and that just brings more trouble onto them. The TSA gets down on them more. They wonder, what do you have this for? And then they take them in the back. They make them strip down, and then it's just a whole humiliating, embarrassing experience for trans men. And I know multiple stories where this has happened at the airport and also crossing the border, where men have been taken and just stripped down, and it's just humiliating. And there's also the danger of sexual assault. There's still the danger of sexual assault, probably in any situation, but certainly maybe it may be less so if you have a penis, you know. At least you don't have what they think is a vagina. And so it's a tough situation for those of us who travel, and particularly for those of us who are color. So that's why I come to that. What I was talking a little earlier about, sometimes some of us have identities that make our trans status vulnerable in ways that we wouldn't even imagine, because our trans status isn't necessarily easily visible. So, for example, one of the things I experience a lot is I get racially profiled. I'm a black man, by the way, and I'm a light-skinned black man, and so I get profiled as sometimes as in a quote illegal alien. Or I get profiled. Just a couple of weeks ago, I got profiled as a, quote, packy terrorist. Police just swooped in on me, and it was crazy. It was ridiculous.
Oh, my gosh.
If you want me to tell you, I'll tell you that story later. It's a little different. It's not really related to the topic, but I can come back to it if you want. We probably want to know now what in the world happened.
I think our cable listeners are very interested, so it'd be great if you could just touch on it.
Yeah, actually, maybe I will use it as an example. So, this is a good example. Okay, so, but the other thing I get clocked is as a perp, as a black man, as a perpetrator of or someone who's always sort of up to no good, a menace to society. So since I transitioned, I get pulled over a lot more than I ever have. I get a lot more tickets now. I get stopped by the police, even walking down the street. I'll give you an example of what happened. So I was going I was traveling to the post office. I was walking, taking my little daily walk to the post office, and was going to drop off three copies of Hung Jury. We'd gotten three orders in, and at Transgress Press, I was going to drop these off, and there I was. So I put on this weight vest. It's a 40-pound weight vest, and it's my attempt, Sasha, to get a little exercise in the middle of the day. So
gotcha.
I put on the 40-pound weight vest, and it's a little bit of a break for me in a day for my computer. So I take off down the street. You know, it's about a mile and a half walk. So I'm walking from West Oakland down to Emeryville post office. And so I've got my vest on. It's a 40-pound, you know, and so it's got these weights in it. And so I had on my earphones, and I get down there, and I walk onto the post office, and I drop my packages off. And then I come back and on my way out of the parking lot. And as I get out of the parking lot, police come in from everywhere. One guy rolls up behind me. Another guy rolls in front of me.
Oh, my gosh.
And then there's a helicopter coming down. A helicopter I see above, and I'm thinking, what in the world? And in fact, I had on my iPod, and I didn't even realize that was happening until they came up on me, and I was shocked. Although I've sort of gotten used to it now. He got out of the car, and he said, "You need to stop. You know, what do you have in that? What you got on there right there? What do you have on?" And I said, "What do you mean, what I have on?" And you know, so it turns out they were suspicious about my weight vest. As I was walking through to the Emeryville post office, someone had called the police department at Emeryville and said something like, "There's a Paki terrorist heading down toward the post office with a bomb, with a strapped in a vest, looks like a bomb, with packages." And so that's why the police swooped in. That's why so many came. They were looking for me, and they were looking hard for me. But and that situation was resolved, of course, after it's put the fear of God in me. And I've had other instances that were not so nice, where police have, you know, thrown me up against the wall, searched me for being in a neighborhood 2 o'clock in the morning or something. I happened to be walking home. My wife doesn't even know half of. I never tell her this stuff because she would flip out and worry all the time. But she doesn't know half of this stuff that happens to me. And so what I realized, and so what I'm telling you the story of, is that I may not look, my trans status, my transgender, my transsexual status may not be legibly visible on my body per se, but because I'm a black man, and particularly because I'm an African-American man who is profiled in a variety of different ways, the police, it puts me in dangerous contact with the police. It actually puts it puts me in a situation where my genitalia, my trans status can be exposed. So the moment they pack me down or they take me to jail or what have you, then it becomes obvious that I'm a transsexual black man. And so then that can bring additional assault, additional oppression on me. Does that make sense?
That is. It's so helpful to really dig into, you know, why those intersections matter and what happens and why the safety issue is so important.
Yes, yes, you absolutely, yes. I like the way you put that. That's very well. That's very well put. It's a complicated, there are complicated lives that we live. So we were finding, this is one of the things that we were finding with men's testimonies. So in addition to dispelling a lot of the myths and mythologies, myths and misinformation about genital surgery, we found a whole, lot of information, a whole vault of information, a whole wellspring of information, really incredible insight into what it is to be trans and to be trans male embodied, and to do that, as you beautifully said, in terms of an intersectional life or intersectional existence. So these are the things that we thought were really important to publish. And someone, you know, we need to know about this. We need to know this information. This is knowledge that should be disseminated in our community, and things that we need to be communicating about and helping each other out and designing ways to protect each other. But this is also the stuff that we need to teach in gender theory, and we need to teach these things in academic studies, and we need to do this kind of work in the cultural competency work that we do when we do trainings, whether it's corporate structures or in the private sector, or if it's municipalities and more bureaucratic structures, and teaching, you know, police how to deal with appropriately and respectfully with trans people. So this is, you know, this book did a lot of things that we didn't even anticipate in the beginning that it would have an impact on. And I think one of the pleasant things I've came to realize just last month also, for example, is that when I was at the National Trans Health Summit, I gave a talk on the book, and actually more specifically, I gave a talk, and I should send you these slides that I have too. I'll do that. I gave a talk on general surgery outcomes and cultural theory and gender embodiment. And that was a summit that was attended by a lot of primary care providers, a lot of people who were counselors, social workers, as well as people like epidemiologists, endocrinologists, and in addition to trans people in the community. And so I didn't realize the audience that I had. And so we gave the presentation, went very well, and I got a lot of feedback afterwards. We must have sold about 50 books there to primary care providers. And so what happened is they went away and read the book, and a couple of weeks later I started getting emails from people, not just about the presentation, but also that the book was helping them to help their own clients.
Oh, great.
Can you believe that? What a bonus that was. We had no idea. We didn't anticipate that. We didn't foresee that. But I got great feedback from people working in schools, Sasha, people working in universities, counselors working in high schools, therapists working with our people. The book was helping, was giving them an insight to not only how to better care for their trans clients, but also how to pass on correct information, how to give their trans clients, particularly men, the hope, and to help them, for those men who are interested in general surgery, to give them the hope that there are options out there and possibilities. But it really gave them an insight into this percentage of us who really need to change and make, you know, everything line up, you know, both the genitals with the outside appearance, with the brain and everything as well. So that was a wonderful bonus when we can help other people help ourselves, you know?
That's so great. And also, if you could just let folks know, I think there's probably folks that are interested in getting the book, if you could let folks know how they can find it.
Sure. Our website is at www.transgresspress.org, and it's important to emphasize .org because we were at www.transgress.com, but we moved last month to a new domain, and we have a new address, and what we're going to eventually do, we think, is go nonprofit, because what we want to do at Transgress Press is we want to ultimately, I've got an idea that what we want to do is design a house, basically a homeless shelter in the East Bay. We want to buy a building. In addition to, you know, a lot of the money from hung jury will go to trans organizations to help both men and women with health care needs. So that makes sense, right, for hung jury, for that money to be donated to that. But as a larger whole, one of the projects of Transgress Press is to build a homeless shelter for trans people of whatever ilk, whatever persuasion, color, ethnicity, what have you, because so many of our people are homeless. Mm-hmm. I see so many of the, particularly the women, mm-hmm. So many of our women are homeless. It's not that the men don't suffer. I don't want to try to. I'm not trying to create a hierarchy of oppression. But I see the visible, what seems really visible to me every day in my neighborhood are our women, and particularly our genderqueer kids who just don't have options. And there's a wonderful a program called the Morris Home that's here in Philadelphia. I'm here in Philadelphia right now. Called the Morris Home is specifically for trans folks. And so we want to design a program based on their project and do that out in the East Bay.
Great.
So that we can serve more of our trans people. So this is the part where I sort of started at the beginning when I was saying, you know, we want to make, if people are going to publish and write about us, well, it's not okay to take our lives and build careers off of them and build companies and amass capital and not give anything back to our people. So that's what we're doing in with the press, is that we donate a lot of our proceeds to organizations, like I said, hung jury will go to particularly to health organizations that help folks with, not just with surgical needs, but just health care in general, and not just men, but women, genderqueer folks who you know, along that spectrum. And we hire our own people. And so many of us are unemployed or are underemployed, yet so many of us are actually, you know, very, very well educated, but can't find jobs or can't get our, you know, can't keep jobs, can't keep, or we get fired from jobs that we had when we transition. And so So one of the other things, too, is that we employ only trans people to do work for us. And so we're trying to build this model of giving back to the community in that respect through the press. So, yeah, people can find it at www.transgresspress.org. That's where Hung Juries is. And it's also on Amazon.com, but we would prefer.
And I would imagine that the book's pretty helpful for folks who are considering, you know, their different options too, their different genital confirming surgeries. And
that's right. That's right. That was actually our target audience. We just didn't realize we had all these other audiences too that would come in to get something to it. So our primary audience at the time was for men who was to provide hope for men who wanted to pursue genital surgery, and not just hope, but to provide them with a guidebook, so to speak, because one of the things you get with this book, if you're a man who's interested in this process, is that you get you read other people's experiences, and it brings up for you, it helps you think about questions. Mm. It helps you think about the issues that come up along the way, and there's so many different issues. It isn't just the question of which is a huge question, of course, but it isn't just a question of what kind of surgery that you want, or who you want to do that surgery with, how much it costs, where you're going to do it at. But there's all kinds of other issues having to do with traveling, for example, and things that come up around traveling, things that come up around complications and issues like, you know, what to do when certain complications arise, how to plan and plot this journey as you move through it, because it's a bit of a lengthy journey. Yeah. For people. It's, you know, you don't just come in and out in one shot. I wish that were the case, but it usually involves multiple surgeries. But what this book does is it also provides people with a kind of a roadmap or some guidelines of what to think about and how to talk to and how to do the research, how to talk to surgeons, and how to know which procedure is the best for you. By reading and thinking about, you know, what other people, their experiences and what they've dealt with in there. So yeah, there's a range of different kinds of surgeries that are represented. And I think the book is kind of like an advice manual, too. It reads in that way for many guys. And we have other books that are coming out, too. I mean, we're going to come out with the biography of Lou Sullivan.
Oh, great.
Yeah, that's Bryce Smith is going to write that, and that's going to come out in about a year, 2014. And then we have another book that's going to come out. We actually acquired a book just recently, Letters for My Brothers. We're going to do the third edition for that book.
Oh, great.
We acquired that from another publisher, and so that'll come out sometime in August. And we will pair that book. We'll sell it separately. And one of the nice things about acquiring Letters for My Brothers for us is that the book right now is kind of, you know, it's $23 with the present publisher. But when we acquire the book, we'll be able to lower it to about $15 and make that book a lot more affordable for trans folks and for anybody in general, but particularly for our community, because I think that's one of the things also it's important is to make sure that things are affordable for people, because a lot of times we're underemployed or unemployed. So yeah, we have new titles come out, Letters for My Brothers. We have another book actually coming out called Stealth World. Well, let's see, the biography of Lou Sullivan, it's called Yours in Liberation, The Queer Life of Trans Activist Lou Sullivan. And it's already a dissertation, and right now we're turning it over into and editing into a manuscript. And so that should be out sometime next summer of 2014. We're very happy to publish that book. Really psyched, because Lou was such an important piece of our trans history that's not been told. So we also have another book as well. It's called Stealth World, Hiding in Plain Sight. And that book is a testimony of trans people who prefer to have our identities and our medical histories. We prefer to just have some control over that in terms of who we disclose that to. I like to be careful about how I define. I actually don't like the word stealth. I have a hard time with it. But I look just like I have a hard time with words like passing and other things like that. You know, but also language is imperfect, and we're still in the process of inventing it. But that's what the authors are using I think that's what the word term they want to use, and I think they're going to problematize it also in the introduction.
Okay.
So I don't think they're just going to use it. I don't think they're just going to use it without any sense of self-reflexivity. But you know, they wanted to tell this story of trans folks who just prefer to have some control over that medical and gender history and disclose when we want to. And sometimes maybe a better word would be low to no disclosure. Mm-hmm. I've heard that term sort of used as well. But it's about testimonies by people who live stealth. And what that book is designed to do is to sort of also take on some of the discourse about trans folks who choose not to be out and open about our medical histories, and the notion that somehow that we are normative, or that somehow we're just sort of assimilating into the normative mainstream, that we're not activists, that we don't do revolutionary work in terms of being able to critically intervene in situation in oppressive circumstances, or being able to educate people. Mm. So that's actually not true. There's a lot of it's complicated the way all trans people live their lives in complicated ways.
Yeah.
I don't think it's difficult, and I think it's difficult to say that we all have a sort of that there's someone out there who has a sort of a unified, unitary journey. Because even some of the people who don't disclose to anyone, whether their job or family. I know people who are incredible trans activists. Now they would describe themselves as stealth,
mm-hmm.
meaning that they don't disclose on their job,
mm-hmm.
And that they're careful, or it may not be something they necessarily talk about with friends when they first meet them, or they sort of don't just sort of out themselves in terms of their history.
Mm-hmm.
But these people are incredible trans activists. Mm-hmm. I mean, they come to conferences, they have organizations.
Mm-hmm.
They do work in the community, so it's complicated the way
mm-hmm.
People live their lives in terms of disclosing and not disclosing,
mm-hmm.
and we can't just sort of make assumptions about folks just in terms of what we think their politics should be, or in terms of the politics that we hold. Just because I might want to be out, and I don't care what others think, and I actually think being out is I can educate and do more
mm-hmm.
work in the world, doesn't mean the next guy can't do that, or
right.
the next girl can't do that, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if they choose to just be quieter about their identities
mm-hmm.
and histories. So yeah, we have some really interesting titles coming out, and I'm really proud of the work that people are doing, and I think it's some really good stuff.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Tristan, for this is such an important conversation, you know, deconstructing these myths. And I know I personally have learned a ton already, and I really look forward to reading your book.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Right. And I just really, again, just don't so much appreciate, you know, the conversation. It's a conversation I haven't really heard before. So this is new for me, and I really appreciate your work.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Do you want me to tell you about one more book?
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, I think one of something that's really coming out kind of incredible, it'll probably be the next, but there'll be Letters from My Brothers, which we'll republish that in August. But the next one that comes out, the next text that we published directly from us, will be a book called Brotherhood is Powerful.
Oh, great.
And it's an anthology of liberationist writings by transsexual men. And that book is actually edited by Xander Keek, who's an international activist and a guy who does a lot of work in the community. He goes to conferences all over the place. He does a lot of speaking and does a lot of good activist work on behalf of trans rights, male and female, and he's a very, very smart man. And so he's decided to put together this collection called Brotherhood is Powerful. And this is a book that looks at what brotherhood means for trans guys, and in different contexts, different cultural contexts, different ethnic contexts, class perspectives. And I think it also, when we talk about taking on myths or doing that sort of myth-busting kind of thing, this is going to be a really bold anthology because people are going to, I think some guys are going to take on some issues that that we sort of don't want to deal with in our community, and some of the things, particularly around transitioning to manhood and what that means for some of us who are coming out of feminist backgrounds
uh-huh.
and also lesbian feminist backgrounds or radical feminist backgrounds and what that means to sort of become men in a world where we don't want to become necessarily the normative oppressive men or model of masculinity, but we also think that there's a lot more other opportunities and possibilities of manhood that you can have other than just simply this notion that you either have to be a normative male or you have to be this sort of non-normative or non-gender-conforming male. So in other words, that's, I think, why he wanted to do it with trans. He insists on using the word transsexual is because he wants to bring in a lot of men who identify as men and also as trans men, but men who are really sort of rethinking reforming their notion of feminism and what their queer politics are in light of their choices of masculinities that might seem mainstream but really aren't.
So
I think this is going to be a great piece as well, and it's actually going to have a lot of pretty well-known names, both scholars and activists in the community. And so I'm really pleased to be producing. We're really pleased to be doing this book also. And you probably recognize the title as kind of a riff on Sisterhood is Powerful. An anthology of liberations. I think this is going to be, and it's going to take on different issues, things having to do with family and parenting and partners, men, masculinity, and male culture. I think people are going to deal with issues of male privilege and vulnerability. I've read some of the pieces, and they're just outstanding.
Much needed.
Really outstanding and much needed. You're absolutely right. Much needed, and gives a new spin, a new angle. Because I think what's happening, Sasha, is I think we're moving into another generation of trans. Mm-hmm. And so there are some of – and so what's happening, you have another younger generation of trans that are emerging, that are becoming visible, and some of us older guys who were transitioning sort of in the 90s and in the 2000s. So you have two different perspectives, but this is also most definitely, our second generation or second wave. And you have so what's happening is you have men who transitioned at a later age, and they're rethinking some of the things that they've learned in various political communities, whether they're feminist or lesbian or heterosexual communities, because certainly that's another part I want to say, too, that I think sometimes trans men who are coming out of heterosexual context are sometimes left out, or they're not as visible and when we talk about trans men, because sometimes I think we assume that most of the men had been lesbian identified and hence butch identified, and so